Colin Russell, who's here with us this evening, is from the zoology department, and he traces how viruses evolve and spread around the world, and specifically things like the flu, which comes to town every year. And it might surprise you to know that the flu kills in the UK about 20,000 people every year, which is actually quite a big number, and we'll find out why this evening. Colin.
Thanks very much, Chris. Good evening, everyone in Bulgaria, and good evening, everyone in Cambridge. Thank you all very much for coming this evening. It's a pleasure and a privilege to be able to talk to all of you. Judging by the number of people in this room and the number of you there in Bulgaria, I'm estimating there's probably about 60 or 70 people here tonight. And that means that at least three people in this room, and in Bulgaria as well, have direct ancestors who died in the 1918 Spanish flu pandemic. It killed that many people. We're talking hundreds of millions of people around the world dead as a result of a single viral epidemic. Now, the prospect of another 1918 pandemic is indeed very frightening. And especially when we hear all of the reports in the media these days about bird flu and H5N1, and we hear statistics like 50% of the people who get these viruses are dying from them, it's indeed a very scary proposition to think that these viruses could transmit human to human and cause similar levels of mortality on a global scale. But a pandemic doesn't necessarily need to be 1918. There's actually been two other human flu pandemics in the last 100 years. There was one in 1957, and there was one in 1968. But we don't talk very much about those because not as nearly as many people died in either of those pandemics as died in 1918. And so actually, in those two pandemics, in each of them, only approximately five times the number of people who die from seasonal flu every year died in either of those pandemics. And so while a pandemic is never a good thing, it doesn't necessarily have to be 1918. And once a pandemic is over, we're left with years and years, if not decades, of seasonal flu. And it's those same viruses that happened in that pandemic that are circulating as seasonal flu in the following years. So, since the last pandemic in 1918, we've had the H3N2 subtype of influenza viruses circulating around the world. Prior to that pandemic, it was the H2N2 subtype of influenza viruses. And when the pandemic comes along, it replaces all of the influenza viruses that were circulating before, and it replaces them with the pandemic viruses. Now, some statistics, as Chris mentioned earlier, about seasonal flu. So each year, approximately 5 to 15% of the world's population gets infected with influenza viruses. So that means, on average, each year, 600 million people are infected with flu. Now, this results in approximately, well, it's difficult to say hospitalizations, especially when we factor in hospitalization rates in the third world, but in the UK, we're looking at approximately 100,000 hospitalizations associated with flu each year. And like Chris said earlier, approximately 20,000 people in the UK die from flu each year. And this is just normal seasonal flu. On a global scale, looking at approximately 500,000 deaths each year. So still, when we're talking about seasonal flu, we're looking at 500,000 deaths worldwide per year. So even the prospect of seasonal flu is still a scary thing. Now, influenza viruses evolve rapidly. And they evolve so rapidly that the vaccine against influenza virus has had to be updated almost 30 times in just the last 40 years. And it's because the virus can change to avoid our immune system. Our immune system thinks it has seen the virus before, but it's changed just a little bit, and our immune system can't recognize it anymore. So, actually, this week is a very important week for influenza vaccines because it's this week that the decision is made at the WHO as to what viruses will go into the vaccine for the upcoming winter. So those viruses that will go into the vaccine to be used in November and December of the coming year. And as a matter of fact, if I weren't here with you this evening, I'd be in Geneva right now. So instead, I've got a red-eye flight first thing in the morning to be there with all of them. But I'd much rather be here with you tonight. So thank you very much. So the influenza virus evolves so rapidly that we can really watch evolution in our lifetimes, which is not something that we could do for any plant or animal that I know of. But for influenza virus, we don't even need a lifetime to see evolution. We can see evolution on just the scale of a couple of years. The virus changes so much within a year, we need to update the vaccine. And that's evolution in action that we can really see. So when we say that the virus is evolving, what exactly do we mean? So in the case of influenza virus, we're talking about the evolution of the proteins on the surface of the virus that our immune system recognizes. And though you may not recognize it, you probably already know the names of these proteins. Because when we talk about bird flu in the media, for example, we talk about influenza H5N1. Or when we talk about seasonal flu, we talk about influenza H3N2. Well, that's actually the virus name for the surface proteins. So there's two proteins on the surface of the virus that our bodies recognize. They're the H protein, the hemagglutinin, and the N protein, the neuraminidase. And it's actually these two proteins that are changing when the virus is evolving. When we talk about influenza virus evolution, we're actually talking about these two proteins picking up a small number of changes gradually over time, evolving just as everything else does. And over time, it picks up these changes slowly, and then eventually, the proteins are sufficiently different from the virus last year or 2 years ago, such that a person who was infected with that virus wouldn't be able to recognize these viruses as the same virus, and so that person would get sick all over again. Now, an important thing to remember when we're talking about virus evolution is that viruses aren't sentient beings. It's not something that they can choose to do. They don't choose to make these changes. They don't say, if I made my surface proteins a little bit different, I'd be able to infect lots more people. Virus can't choose to do that. Now, that doesn't mean that there isn't something out there selecting for these changes. These changes are just happening to the virus, but nature is operating on those changes. Nature says, you are the most likely virus to infect lots of other people. So therefore, you will be the one that succeeds, and all of you who stayed the same and everyone is now immune to you, you will go extinct because you can't infect people anymore. Now, this is really the sort of crux of virus evolution in general. Right? Selection operates on a virus's or any pathogen's ability to infect more people. And if you can't infect someone, you're going to die. And so fitness can really be assessed in terms of your ability to infect other people. Now, for influenza viruses, nature selects viruses' ability to change, to be different from the viruses that were circulating before. And so if you haven't changed, you're going to go extinct. If you have changed, there's a reasonable chance that you will survive. But avoiding immunity is just one strategy for evolving as a virus. As we all know, evolution can select for multiple strategies, and there's multiple different ways that viruses can evolve in order to be good at infecting other individuals. And so I'd like to step away from flu for a little bit now and think about some other pathogens and sort of contrast them with influenza. And so first I'd like to compare influenza to rabies virus. Now, rabies and influenza are radically different from one another. So influenza evolves by evading immunity and generates an immune response, whereas rabies effectively generates no immune response. It just kills its host. It doesn't need to worry about reinfecting anyone because once you've had it, unless you're a human and you've been vaccinated, you're probably dead. So rabies, though it doesn't evolve to become different from the viruses that were circulating before, it has actually evolved a really interesting set of tricks in order to be able to transmit and to be able to infect other people or other animals very efficiently. And so rabies does a few really clever things. And so just taking you through the brief sort of pathogenesis of a rabies virus infection, because this is where the clever tricks are. So a rabbit animal bites you or me, and so it bites on the arm. And the viruses migrate along the nervous system to the spinal cord. And when they get to the spinal cord, they move up the spinal cord and into the brain. And when they get to the brain, they replicate like there's no tomorrow. I mean, all the virus just it gets hell-bent on making as many copies of itself as possible. And when the virus concentration in the brain starts getting really high, the viruses migrate into the salivary glands of the infected individual. Now, this makes a lot of sense, because if you're going to transmit by biting, there has to be contact between saliva and the blood of a susceptible individual. And so the virus needs to be where the saliva is being made. So going to the salivary glands makes a lot of sense. Now, but the virus does a really clever thing in the brain of the infected individual. So during all of this replication, it actually starts to do some neurological damage to the sections of the brain responsible for paranoia. And the virus starts disrupting the brain's normal function, and it starts making the infected individual really paranoid. And so if we think about this from an animal's perspective, when you get paranoid, you get bitey. You know, it's time to bite everything you can find. Everyone is infringing on your territory. Everyone wants to steal your food. Let's start biting. Now, this is great for transmission if you spread through biting. But it also, rabies also does something really clever. It makes you hydrophobic. You become afraid of water. Now, if you're transmitting through saliva, this is a really smart thing to do as well. Because when you get dehydrated, your saliva starts thickening up, and if you get really dehydrated, you start foaming at the mouth, and so you have all of these viruses just hanging right around your mouth if you're infected with rabies. And by becoming hydrophobic, by becoming dehydrated, you're actually increasing the virus concentration right around where it needs to be so that you can transmit the disease to another individual. That's pretty damn clever. So, rabies didn't choose to make any of these decisions. And when these viruses first emerged in terrestrial mammals, it probably didn't do any of these things as well as it does them now. So where rabies didn't choose to do any of these things, nature definitely selected for viruses that made animals paranoid because they were more likely to bite other animals. It selected for the viruses that made the individuals hydrophobic because it increased the probability of each bite transmitting more viruses. Now, rabies also does another clever thing, which is when it gets into animals in areas of low population density. So you can imagine that if you have lots of other individuals that you can infect, the probability of you finding another individual to transmit your infection to is pretty high. And if you can do that, it doesn't really matter how fast the virus kills you, as long as there's an opportunity for you to give your infection to someone else. But in areas of low population density, particularly in the Arctic, there aren't that many other mammals around, and so it can be pretty difficult for you to find someone to give your infection to. And so rabies has made a trade-off in the Arctic, which is it kills you much, much more slowly. It still kills you, but more slowly than it does in continental Europe, for example, where fox population density, rabies is primarily carried in foxes, is quite high. So in the Arctic, it made a trade-off. It kills you more slowly, and it does that by replicating much less quickly. And in that way, there's less virus around the mouth at any particular point in time. And so you're less likely to transmit with each bite, but you have a much longer time frame in order in which you can transmit. And in doing so, you increase the probability that you'll find someone else to spread your virus to, and thereby survive. So, moving away from rabies, thinking about pathogens that don't transmit very well. Let's think about Ebola. Ebola is a scary pathogen, especially how it's portrayed to us in movies and in the media. It's downright scary. I mean, you bleed out of your eyes. That's never good. So, Ebola is thought to have originated in bats. And Ebola doesn't kill bats. Actually, it's thought that Ebola doesn't even make bats sick. It's been in bats for a sufficiently long time that the virus has co-evolved with them, and they don't even get sick from carrying the virus. Now, when humans get it, of course, we get incredibly sick, and the mortality in some outbreaks is something around 80% of people who get infected die from Ebola. Now, humans are just accidental carriers of Ebola virus, though. And so it originates in bats, and humans most frequently get it from gorillas. And it's a big problem in Western Africa because, well, humans get it from gorillas, and it's not natural for us to have blood-blood contact with gorillas, except in the bushmeat trade. So, you go out into the woods, you're hunting for gorillas or any sort of bushmeat, and you come across a gorilla that's already dead. Now, it's bleeding a lot, which would turn most of us off, but if you're really hungry, Or you're poor and you need money. It looks like free meat. And so you take it back to your village. You probably don't have the most sophisticated butchering equipment. You're probably doing it with machetes. You've got a couple of small cuts on your hands. Suddenly we have blood-blood contact. And the individual cutting up the gorilla now has Ebola. Now, this individual is going to have the same sort of symptoms. He's going to bleed out of his eyes. He's going to bleed out of the middle section of his torso. It's not going to be pretty. And in the West, we would stay away from that sort of thing. We would avoid it like the plague. But in many communities, especially in rural Western Africa, there's traditions of washing the body of the recently deceased. It's where everyone in the community will get together and they will give the body a communal bath. Now, if we're looking at blood transmission here, putting a body that's bleeding into water and getting into the water with it is a recipe for disaster. Anybody who's got small cuts on them, or big cuts for that matter, is opening themselves up to an Ebola infection. And so Ebola begins to spread through these communities. Many people start dying. And then as the number of cases increases, the risk of getting other people getting infected increases as well. Until you get public health intervention or something to that, something along those lines, Ebola is really nasty. But it's not going to be a problem in the West because it kills its host too fast and its method of transmission just isn't that pretty. Especially when we compare it to something like flu, where all we have to do is sneeze and I could infect every one of you all at once. Just like that. So Ebola in bats is a very highly evolved thing. But in gorillas and in humans, it's practically retarded. It kills itself too fast and it kills its host too fast for it to ever be really effective. Now, thinking of something else that's not particularly good at transmitting, but is affecting millions of people, something like HIV. Now, when it comes to transmitting, HIV is absolutely crap at transmitting. There has to be either blood-blood contact or sexual contact for there to be for the most conventional routes of HIV transmission. Now, compared to something like flu, where I could just sneeze, that's a lot more complicated. And yet, millions of people are infected. Now, one of the big differences between something like flu or Ebola and HIV is that HIV infects its host for years. So it doesn't even have to be good at transmitting. All it has to do is infect you for a really long time, and there's a pretty good chance that at some point, unless you know you're infected, you will unwittingly give that virus to someone else. Now, of course, HIV could kill you quickly, but that would be a stupid thing to do because it doesn't transmit well, and it takes time. And so by killing you slowly, or not even by killing you slowly, just by existing with you slowly, it's able to transmit for a much longer period of time. Now, HIV is doing an interesting evolutionary thing even inside of you. So, you initially get infected, you get this huge initial viremia, and then your immune system comes and it beats that viremia down. But then, the virus, being quite smart, it evolves to evade the immune system and it builds itself up again. But then, our immune system, also very smart, beats that infection down all over again. And this cycle continues just for years. Eventually, and for reasons that still are unclear, the virus wins. It overwhelms the immune system, the person develops full-blown AIDS, and eventually dies. But they're infected for a long time before any of that can happen. Now, it's interesting to contrast HIV with its most closely related mammalian relative. And so HIV is probably killing us because it's a relatively new virus for us. It was only introduced into the human population probably less than 100 years ago. But it's really closely related to a virus in monkeys called SIV, which is simian immunodeficiency virus. And it does very similar things in monkeys. Monkeys have it, they spread it, they infect other monkeys. But there's a big difference, and that is monkeys usually don't get sick. And so they are unwitting carriers of and spreaders of this virus for the duration of their lives, not unlike Ebola in bats. There's no reason to clear the infection. It doesn't hurt them, it doesn't kill them, and it's fine. And this is probably because SIV has been in monkeys for a very long time. When it first appeared in monkeys, it was probably highly pathogenic, much like HIV is for us. But it has evolved over time to be non-pathogenic because at some point it became advantageous for the virus to not kill its host. It was able to infect more people, or more monkeys, that is, by not killing its host. Now, interestingly, SIV didn't get rid of monkeys, even when it was highly pathogenic. So that gives us a lot of hope for HIV, and I'll get more onto that for a second. But the other interesting thing is that monkeys didn't get rid of SIV either. So they still have it, it's just non-pathogenic. And so maybe one route for treating HIV in humans is actually not to get rid of the virus, but to actually speed up its adaptation into humans in such a way that it no longer is actively trying to kill us. Now, there's two important differences between HIV in humans and SIV in monkeys. And so one of them is that humans are far more novel in the ways that we try to spread the viruses amongst ourselves. And this is particularly evident in blood transfusions and intravenous drug users. Before, we knew to screen blood donated blood for HIV viruses. Lots of people got infected through tainted blood. And still, today, the world over, people unwittingly infect themselves with HIV by sharing needles. Monkeys don't do either one of these things.
Often.
I did see an interesting documentary about that, but we can talk about it later. The other thing that we do that monkeys don't do is we actively try to treat the infection. And I'm not suggesting that this has anything to do with why the virus ultimately kills us, but there's an interesting evolutionary story associated with treating HIV with drugs. And so the most common method of treating HIV today is just generically referred to as combination therapy. And this involves going in with multiple antiretroviral drugs at the same time. And it turns out that it's really important to go in with more than one drug, and more specifically, to go in with at least three drugs when you're trying to treat someone with HIV. And the reason for that is that it seems perfectly possible for HIV viruses to evolve to become resistant to one drug and to two drugs at the same time. But there are very few cases where HIV viruses within one individual can become resistant to three drugs at the same time. Three seems to be the magic number. If you treat someone with three drugs, the virus cannot evolve to evade it. Now, this created a big dilemma when combination therapy was new in the mid-90s because many people were having adverse reactions to antiretroviral drugs. And so the dilemma is, what do you do? Someone's having an adverse reaction to these drugs. So do you take them off of one of the drugs, one at a time, to figure out which one is causing the adverse side effects? Or do you take them off of all of the drugs at the same time and risk the viremia building up to initial infection levels? And the answer is counterintuitive, because the answer is you take them off of all of the drugs at the same time. And the reason for that is that if you take them off of just one of the drugs, or if you take them off of two of the drugs, the virus can evolve to become resistant to the drugs that that person is still taking. And then when you go in with another drug, so let's say you took out one drug and you replace it with another drug. In the process of replacing it, the virus was able to become resistant to two of the drugs that you were taking. And then when you added the third one, it only had to become resistant to one more. And it's perfectly capable of doing that. So by taking a person off of only one drug at a time, you actually create multi-drug resistant HIV. So the virus is clever. It can do many things. And we can, in some ways, outwit it. But it does have strategies to outwit us, too. The last disease that I'm going to talk about is another example of pathogens that transmit really badly. And this is probably the pathogen that transmits the absolute worst. Hepatitis C virus. Hepatitis C is next to impossible to spread. It requires direct blood-to-blood contact. Sexual contact is not enough. The cases of sexually transmitted hepatitis C, very rare. Even though it's incredibly difficult to transmit, it's estimated that there are 200 million people in the world that are infected with hepatitis C virus. Now, the scary thing is that in the Western world, 90% of those individuals who were infected through blood transfusions before we knew to screen for hepatitis C. More specifically, before we even really knew about hepatitis C. Because the good news is that for all of those people who are infected, they're unlikely to ever express symptoms. And those people who do express symptoms will only express them later in life, and it tends to be non-fatal. Now, this is a great example of a virus that has evolved to adapt to humans. We have a long evolutionary relationship with hepatitis C, and we know it's no longer pathogenic for us. Now, this gets at a very interesting question, which is, okay, well, there's this virus that we don't know very much about that it turns out many, many people are carrying. Well, how many other viruses are there right now that we don't know about? I mean, either in animals that have yet to get to humans or that we're carrying right now. Because, I mean, for example, how many viruses are we carrying right now that are doing us no harm? Or that will do us harm later, and we just haven't figured out specifically what that harm is, or we've always associated with those symptoms with some other ailment. To give you a clue, and I will stop after this, is if we took all of the genetic material in our bodies and we ground it up and we isolated it and we determined where it came from, only 10% of the genetic material that we're carrying around, and I mean in our bodies in their entirety, right now, only 10% is human. 90% of the genetic material that we carry around every day is from bacteria. So long story short, we're probably carrying a lot of stuff. Thank you very much.